Nightlife. Bite-sized history.
This mortal coil.
Because one of the more unexpected results from the UK leaving the European Union is that the British Museum may finally be forced to hand back one of its most famous artefacts to the country it was taken from more than 200 years ago. According to a leaked clause from the European Union's negotiating mandate, the EU is going to ask that the return of the Elgin marbles be a condition of Britain signing any new kind of trade deal. Now, the Elgin marbles, you may know, were part of a frieze that ran around the Parthenon in Athens, a building that's dedicated to the goddess Athena. You may well have been there, you may have seen it. But what exactly was the role of the Parthenon, and how did the Elgin marbles fit into it? The story of the Parthenon is full of twists and turns, and our guest is here to tell you that story and that of the marbles, Rasidas Kiralas, a professor of Byzantine and Greek history at the University of Sydney. Hello, Ras, and welcome to Nightlife.
Thank you, Mark, for the invitation.
Now, you're Greek yourself, but you're not from Athens, but you did grow up near another very famous archaeological site. Could you tell us about that?
Well, I was born in Olympia, where the Olympic Games began, and I remember that until we were young people, very young, 69, 70 years old, I was 9, 8 and 9 years old, I was playing at the stadium of Olympia. We were playing soccer, of course, not ancient Greek games, because they were all in the nude, as you remember, so we had to...
You wore clothes, I hope.
Exactly, and we were very decent. And there was a very interesting, the most beautiful space to play soccer back then. But then, in the 70s, it became an archaeological space.
Wow.
And we were not allowed to enter that. And I still remember as a child, you know, holding the ball in my hands, and we're going to play soccer now. There's no place anywhere else around here. That showed to me the continuity between in the use of space from antiquity to this day.
It is amazing. And when you were playing football at the age of 9 on this, you know, site of such historical importance, were you aware of the significance?
Well, we were studying, of course, at school, but mostly it was the oral history that my grandmother used to tell me before sleeping. You know, that was the bedtime stories, that there was this place where the ancient Greeks came together and they had the games every 4 years, and it was fun, and the women were not allowed to go there, and the whole place was very mythological, as you understand, because you can show me the women whose children were competing in the games because they wanted to see their sons, because only men were allowed to do that, had raised a whole, as she used to call it, tomb, a whole hill, so they could go up there and see what was happening in the stadium.
Oh, okay.
So the place to this day is called the women's place, you know, where the women were going.
Oh, the women's place.
The women's place, where women would go and look at their own children competing. So there was a lot of oral history, you know, as you understand, oral history means you confuse the centuries, because my grandmother talked about at a certain stage, the Turks came and destroyed the games. She wanted to say the Persians. Have seen the movie 300 and the other movies of the same the same period. But essentially, as you see in oral history and oral imagination, all of these things are collapse and conflated. And for people, especially non-alphabetized people, the people who haven't studied, like my grandmother, who's illiterate, oral memory didn't make the difference between the 6th century BC and the 6th century AD.
I see. So that's what you mean by it's a continuous timeline.
Completely.
I think that's so interesting, actually, because I do think we often think of the ancient Greeks and the modern Greeks as being two quite distinct nations. And I know this is part of your work, is making sure that thread between the two is not cut.
Well, it was never cut.
Of course.
Sometimes I believe that, unfortunately, it was never cut, because essentially, as you see, the ancient Greeks produced such a great civilization that now we are the slaves to that civilization.
Right.
We have not been emancipated towards that culture. We are essentially the servants to this day, because we haven't produced something similar or analogous or parallel to what they have done in the past. So essentially, we're the custodians of that legacy, of that heritage, but at the same time, we we know that there's a certain problem vis-a-vis these ancients because they were so great and so important, so in the end, so universal, and we have become local. We have remained local. We have remained really sort of closed within our sphere there. But the continuity is obvious, extremely obvious, in the oral history, as I mentioned. Amongst the intellectuals, there was never a break between antiquity and modern age amongst the intellectuals. And, of course, the educational system, which every time was rebuilt and reestablished, always brought these things together.
Well, let's go now to back in history to the ancients. Let's go to the Parthenon. When was the Parthenon built and why was the Parthenon built?
Well, the Parthenon is probably, as you know, the most emblematic building of antiquity, of ancient Greece in particular, because it was, and it was built between the four, by, first of all, we must acknowledge the person, the politician who was, had the vision to build it, and that was the famous leader of the Democratic Party, Pericles. We cannot understand the Parthenon without Pericles. And that was the Periclean era of Athens.
And that's that when Pericles is in charge, that's what they call the golden age of Athens.
Absolutely, because Pericles was, despite the fact that he was a democratically elected, he was a democratically elected leader for 17 years in a row. You know, the ancients had a much more prudent system with the politicians. They had to be re-elected every year. They didn't give them 3 years or 4 years now to be corrupt by focus interests and this kind of thing. So when he was first elected in 448 BC, he had that dream of building a monument to celebrate the victories of all Greeks against the Persian invasions 40 and 50 years ago. As you remember, Marathon, Salamis, and Thermopylae, and then the other. So he built that one in order to honor goddess Athena, who supported, according to the mythology of the period, the Greeks and won that war.
I see. So, according to the mythology, the Greek victory over the Persians was, well, Athena aided them in their victory. So this was to repay her or thank her for her.
To thank her. That was a tribute and an expression of gratitude that they had towards Athena, because Athena was the goddess that protected Athens as well. Athens, Athena, the name is very close, as you understand. So it indicated it was dedicated to Athena. Athena, as you remember, was a virgin goddess and the only woman that was born of a man out of the head of Zeus. And came out with her whole armor and the panoply out of the head of Zeus, which indicates something important, that out of the, you know, the cosmic rhythm that creates the worlds, like Zeus, what Zeus represented in antiquity, wisdom comes out. And she was the goddess of wisdom.
I see. So Zeus is the father of the gods.
And the mother.
And the mother. And from his head emerges the goddess of wisdom.
Well,
it's all very straightforward, really, isn't it?
Absolutely. It's so modern and contemporary, as you understand. Very gender fluid.
Now, is the Parthenon, strictly speaking, a temple?
Well, we don't really know. I mean, probably it was built. You know, that raises the question of the ancient Greek religion and how the ancient Greeks celebrated their religion or understood their religion. Don't forget that the ancient Greek religion didn't have sacred books.
So when you say sacred books, you mean something like the Bible?
Like the Bible.
Yes.
I mean, something close to that was Homer's Iliad, but, you know, but it was not a sacred book. Everybody knew that. Thucydides, who lived during the period of Pericles, criticized that book and says, you know, that's very poetic. He exaggerated. Don't take him seriously and don't take him literally, as he said, Homer. So they didn't have this idea of a sacred book, of a sacred place, of a place that belonged only to priesthood. That only the mystery religion in Eleusis, close to Athens, a very important city. But the Parthenon itself was an open temple. We could go in and out to see the famous golden ivory statue of Athena by Phidias, as you remember, the famous statue which disappeared at a certain stage. So essentially the ancient Greek religion, especially dedicated to Athens, it was a religion of the people, of rituals, of mass rituals, where animals were sacrificed, but the meat was distributed to the people so they could eat, because it was very, very rare to eat meat
Yes.
Despite the fact that we think that the ancient Greeks were eating, the Greeks eat meat. It was a very rare delicacy. Essentially, they ate meat only twice or three times a year. Because it was very expensive. Plus, they needed the animals to produce milk and other things. So they didn't eat. They started after the 60s and 70s, as you understand, with industrialization and the production of this kind of thing. Until then, eating meat was a very rare delicacy. And especially if it was coming for free from the temple, it was even better, as you understand then.
Tell us a little bit about the way that the ancient Greek religion functioned in the everyday life of an Athenian. So today, if you are a Catholic in modern Australia, you know, there are a set of rules that govern your behaviour. Maybe you go to church once a week, and there are some rituals throughout the year. Is that more or less how religion functioned for an Athenian?
Not really. I think that the Athenians had all these festivals, as I said, which essentially festivals. In a way, we have that in Christianity, especially Catholicism and Orthodoxy, because all festivals, religious festivals, were around the natural cycle of seasons. There was a huge festival during spring.
Yeah.
Which today we have Easter for that.
Okay, yes.
And then we have the summer festival. Which today we have for some of us who are of Christian background, is the Assumption of the Virgin Mary on the 15th of August, which is celebrated by everybody. And if you go to Italy, we have this huge mass, sort of a kind of festivals around the cities, and Spain and Portugal and France and this kind of place. And then we have the winter solstice, which was probably the most important celebration, which today is Christmas.
I see. So the modern Christian festivals and observances kind of have analogues or lineages back to ancient
Continue. Creation. I think that it was a conscious practice on behalf of the priests of the patriarchs of the early centuries to simply, essentially, substitute the ancient festivals and rituals and celebrations of heroes. Local heroes with mass, you know, celebrations of saints, of the Virgin, and of course, Jesus Christ.
In the modern era, a lot of religion, and I would say probably most modern religions, in some ways connected to morality or a way of living. The rules or the principles dictate the morality of the follower's life. Is that true for ancient Greece? Did the Athenians follow morality and rules from their gods?
Well, if you study the life of the gods, and very moral and unethical, but the Athenians didn't take God's behavior, as you understand, as the standard for them to behave.
Okay.
On the contrary, I mean, I'll give you an example. Amongst Christianity, remain virgin is one of the most cardinal virtues, as you remember. But for the Athenians, for the ancient Greeks, it was an offense against Aphrodite.
Oh, so it was the opposite.
It was the opposite. We have the story of Hippolytus, the famous tragedy. And Aphrodite decides, because Hippolytus decides to remain chaste and virgin, Aphrodite is offended by that. So decides to punish him. And how does she punish him? Did she punish him by having his stepmother falling in love with him, Phaedra?
Yes, I vaguely remember that story from school.
You know,
yes.
And we have this incestuous, she makes passes to him and he rejects it and then she accuses him and this kind of thing. So that indicates the different concept of morality that we had. They had ethics, that is to say, how you should behave in public space and in the public places as a citizen of the country, of your city.
Okay, so that was more about being an Athenian as opposed to being a follower of the religion.
Exactly. A civic duty, because predominantly it was a civil religion and not a metaphysical, transcendental religion. The ancient Greeks had a perception, as you noticed from the Parthenon, that the goddess was in there. It was the proximity of the divine and the human that was important in antiquity. You know.
Apart from Athena, who were the other gods that were particularly important to the people of Athens?
Poseidon, because he represented the god of Neptune, as we call it, and call him in Latin, the god of the sea, and essentially the Athenian empire or the Athenian domination after the Persian Wars was based on the sea. And don't forget that it was something that was the model of the British Empire as well later on these kind of things. And I think Poseidon plays a very important role in the whole structure of the Athenian mythology and the Athenian self-mythologization. Then we have, of course, Apollo, the protector of arts, because the Athenian democracy around the Acropolis. Have you ever been to the Acropolis?
I have been to the Acropolis, yes.
You see, below that, there was a famous theatre of Dionysus.
Mm. Yes.
Where the great tragedies were performed. Because these things were connected, the religious and the artistic. And democracy had one way of expressing itself, its self-perception, tragedy.
Yes, of course.
And comedy at the same time. Aristophanes, the comedy by Aristophanes, which was an amazing, you know, just very irreverent and extremely, extremely shocking. If we perform today, Lysistrata, for example, when women go on sexual strike, all right, to this day is a bit shocking, as you understand.
I remember that. I've read Lysistrata. So that, the plot of that one is where all the women of Athens say they're going to refuse sex to their partners unless they go off to war, is that right?
No, they stop fighting.
Oh, stop fighting. I've
stop
got it wrong.
Fighting. We had enough of that. Stop fighting. So it's very, very sort of a kind of cheeky, you know, just comedy, because essentially they can't restrain themselves.
Right.
So the whole thing of transgression and restrain is very interesting in that respect. So the Athenians had a wide variety of gods, plus local god Cecrops, who supposedly built Athens, and then Theseus, the builder of Athens, the actual builder of
Theseus.
Athens.
Theseus.
They were actually venerated as deities, but not in the modern sense that we have now, not like Jesus Christ or Virgin Mary or like the saints, but as local deities that is existing in that specific place.
Yes, as you were saying, it's... you know, for modern religions, often the deities or the gods are distant or on another plane, whereas in the ancient world, they are much more proximate. They are almost as though people you could meet.
Well, they were meeting them every day.
Yeah.
Don't worry, they had all these myths that Zeus comes down in the form of a common mortal. That's why for them, if you remember, one of the main virtues of antiquity, and actually I think that the Greeks today have continued to a certain degree until the 70s and 80s, it was a concept of hospitality.
Mm.
And they had to be hospitable to everybody because they thought it was Zeus in the form of a common human being was coming to the house. And if that was God, the great God, who was coming to the house and they were disrespectful, they would have been punished. So, or they have been unlucky throughout the years. So for them, the idea of philoxenia, hospitality, is probably the most important duty that they had towards God, to accept every stranger and every foreigner as part of the family.
For those who have travelled to Athens, the Acropolis sits on a hill and can be seen from nearly anywhere in the city, and the Parthenon is the most visible or striking structure there. What was the function of the Acropolis for everyday Athenians?
Well, they used to meet. You know, the Athenians were notorious for bubbling, as they say. You know, when St. Paul visited Athens, do you remember, in the Acts of the Apostles, says that all the Athenians, the only thing that the Athenians like is going around talking about new things that they invent every day. And they love hearing, says, about odd stuff that happens in the world and completely novel ideas about life.
Right.
So essentially it was a meeting place.
Yeah,
it was not a sacred place. We call it today in modern Greek, there's a sacred hill, as they call it. But in reality, it was a place that belonged to the people. It was a place of democracy, of the open democracy, that people could come and go. They could meet with their friends and go down as well and come back. Today, of course, you have to pay a ticket, which is really expensive. Mm. You know, but in antiquity, it was the most visible symbol of the open democracy that the Athenians had established.
Yeah, so every Athenian had the right to go up to this most the most important place in the city and take part in these discussions?
Absolutely. I mean, especially the free citizens. But later on, especially after the 4th century, we had the people, you know, for the migrants who came to the city. I mean, there are many conservatives who complained about Athenian multiculturalism in that period. Why do you allow all these foreigners to come here and give us their food and infuse us with their ideas, they used to say. Very interesting, sort of a parallel with what happens today. But it belonged to the people, to the free citizens of Athens. But everybody could go there as well, especially visitors and this kind of thing, because the building was really not simply impressive, but it's very interesting as well from an architectural point of view, and became the model for the Romans later on, for many, many other buildings from in the East and the West to this day, because essentially it looks simple, like rectangular, but in reality there's nothing straight in that building. Everything is curved, everything is bent so that it can have more, essentially more stability and more endurance, because there were many earthquakes.
Right, and I did. I remember learning at school that also the columns and the sides were bent a little bit to correct for the bend in the human eye.
In the human eye, exactly.
So that when you look at it, it appears to be dead straight, but actually it's slightly bent.
Well, actually, you know, they have called the Parthenon the masterpiece of visual illusion. Because so it looks, I mean, the whole thing is not what it looks to be.
Yeah.
The whole building, it's totally different from what it looks to be. But it's, and if you studied how it was built, and that was made in essentially 10 to 12 years, you know, just the meticulous architectural planning by Ictinus and Callicrates, the two architects, is stunning, is amazing. I mean, today we have discovered in some forgotten corners of the building the plans that they did, how to perfect the
oh, really?
They used to carve it, you know, they didn't have paper back then, as you understand. Yeah. So they have to have this system of noting on the stone how to do things. So we discover that, and it's a very interesting thing how, I mean, it's amazing the geometry of the whole thing, the idea of how to make it more solid, because, as I said, there are many earthquakes in Athens, and how to create a building, as Pericles said, which will be a delight and a wonder for all centuries to come.
Well, he certainly achieved that.
He did. He did. And he was essentially the architect behind the whole thing. I mean, the man who envisioned to build something like that. And I think that Athens became the symbol of the open democracy, the open of the arts, of philosophy, of politics, because of these achievements that happened during these 30 years of complete and pure democracy that we had in Athens.
Well, let's turn now to the marbles themselves, the Elgin marbles. And I should point out that Georgina has texted in to say that we should really refer to these antiquities by their correct name, the Parthenon marbles. We shouldn't call them the Elgin marbles because, you know, it's things like that that are maybe preventing them from being returned to Athens. So tell us about the Parthenon marbles.
Well, the Parthenon marbles are part of the building, and that's the interesting thing. That's why Greece insists that they must be returned to the original building. It's not simply they've been returned to Greece or to the... They have to go back to the original building itself. The building must be restored. The building had so many historical adventures. It had been destroyed in many occasions. In the Middle Ages, it became a church, and then it became a mosque, and then it was bombarded by the Venetians, partly destroyed, and after the Greek Revolution, next year we have 200th anniversary of the Greek Revolution, which established the modern Greek state. You know, this building was the first building that the Greeks wanted to restore in its original, to the extent that we can do that, position. But Elgin, Lord Elgin, as you remember, was a dilettante, and if I may say, a plunderer, right? You know, he was going around plundering ancient. It was very common back then in the early 19th century. The Ottoman Empire was disintegrating, collapsing, so the local people could be bribed and allow, especially Westerners, to go and steal all these incredible artifacts that we see. But he as we see in modern museums today. For example, if you go to the Louvre, the centerpiece of Louvre, at the Louvre is the victory of Samothrace, you know, this incredible, or the Venus of Milo, you know, this incredible, two incredible statues, which were essentially taken before the establishment of the Greek state.
Yes, and so this is, it's a wider story, isn't it? As you say, it's not just the Parthenon marbles. There are antiquities all over in museums all over the world, and there are also, and it's not just Greek, it's Roman and Mesopotamian and Chinese and all over the world.
And Nigerian, and I mean, unfortunately, the British Museum wanted to become, how can I say that, the depository, as they said, of human knowledge and universal art. But in reality, they became a storehouse, essentially. They put together everything, you know, without the consent of the people who created them. I mean, this is called the theft. Mm. It was an officially endorsed theft, because nobody gave the consent. Lord Elgin presented a faked document that supposedly had a firman of the Sultan, which was not true because nobody has ever seen it. An Italian translation exists of that, and of the local Pasha of Athens, who gave him the permission to do that. But I think this is, of course, as you understand, not true, because we don't. No, true. We don't really know if that happened, because we don't have any historical evidence. He simply went there, he bribed the local authorities, and he used a chainsaw in the most barbaric and most amateurish way, and he removed all these frieze, you know, all these incredible sculptures from the frieze of the Parthenon and the pediment and the inside. So he transferred them to his... First of all, don't forget that he transferred them to his mansion.
His own house.
Yeah, he wanted them to have a look and enjoy the ancient Greek art. It was a common thing back then to steal antiquities. And of course, as you see, I mean, they say that if Greece demands for the return of the other statues, half of the museums of Europe will be empty. Mm. But I mean, Greece does not ask for the return of the other statues, as in some, because they're single artifacts. That belongs to a complete monument. And yes, we try to restore the monument. We don't try to restore one statue, but a whole building. And that's the importance of this request and demand.
And not only that, unlike individual statues that might be elsewhere, they're very much a symbol of the city itself.
Not simply of the city, I think it's of Athens, of course, but it's a symbol of Greece as well, you know, because essentially it's of Greek culture, of what we call the Hellenic culture, because the Hellenic culture, I mean, is epitomized in those, you know, columns of the Parthenon throughout the centuries. When the Greeks, I mean, sometimes there's a famous anthropologist from England says that human beings, people, cultures are created by the by the buildings they construct.
Wow.
And it's very true. You know, it's a matter of identity, because it's a matter of identification with the building. And probably, if you see, since I said that we have the 200th anniversary of the Greek Revolution, you know, so many things happened during the Revolution that protected the building from being totally destroyed.
The marbles are so beautiful. For anyone who has seen them in the British Museum, they really, you know, blow you away with their beauty. And how were they constructed in that early period to be so lifelike and so perfect?
Well, blame it on Phidias. Phidias probably is, if you go to the New South Wales State Gallery, you will see his name outside in Greek letters as well. Phidias, they have him there, you know, because he was a great artist, first of all, one of the greatest artists that we have before Michelangelo, essentially. And he created all this artistic tradition that we have in Greece. And then, of course, it's more... its variety with the Romans, and then with the Byzantines, and then this and the medieval Europe. But Phidias was he had an eye for details. he created this incredible sense of lifelike because he had, as we can surmise and can reconstruct, he had real models in front of him. And he didn't try to create the difference between that art and the art of Egypt, for example. Art of Egypt is so beautiful as well, so imposing and so, how can I say that, majestic as well, imperial art. This is not imperial art. This is democratic art because the citizens can see themselves up there. They don't see gods only. They don't see holy animals as we see in Mesopotamia or in Egypt. Great art, artistic traditions in themselves, as you said. They see themselves. They see people celebrating the festival of Athena. And they're own daughters and sons going around, you know. So it was for the first time that the human was elevated.
Wow.
To become essentially like God, the demigod, as the Greeks used to say. It's not simply that we had a mixture of the human and the god in the form of an animal that we had in the East, in Eastern traditions. Phidias actually anthropomorphized the divine, gave you completely sort of a kind of human form and human passion, I think the expression of the face. And even if you see, so if you go close now with a new museum, you can see that closer because you can move around the frieze, what survives the frieze. You can see how he gave even details of the human body and the body of Apollo and the other gods that appear there. For example, there's a very interesting mole in one of them.
A mole?
A mole.
On Apollo, the god.
On Apollo, you know, which is a very interesting thing, as you understand, because he wanted to show that the humanity was not an inferior form of existence, but it could transform itself into these ideal forms of beings.
And as you say, in terms of that idea of buildings and structures being emblematic of a culture and a nation, Greece being the birthplace of democracy, it's therefore so fitting that this is this moment in art where art itself is becoming democratic in that way.
Absolutely, because it's the opening, if I may use this term, that essentially the human, the citizen of Athens, the citizen means the person who votes, who voted back then, suddenly sees himself, saw himself or herself, because there are many beautiful artistic representations of women in particular there, because during the period of Pericles, you know, we had the famous discussions between men and women. I mean, there was no real division. There was a division of in the public sphere, but not in the domestic sphere. So you can see all this amazing the representation of the human form as the epitome of natural evolution. Yeah. I mean, it's something which is the beginning of Western rationalism. This is where we think, you know, because we believe that our body is the outcome of millions and millions of years of evolution. And that's what you see there in the end.
How wonderful. And well, we're nearly running out of time, right. But I did want to ask you before we go. So as we said at the beginning, the recent development is, after this long campaign by Greece to have the marbles returned from the British Museum, it now seems that a condition of a trade deal with Europe from the UK and Europe, because of Brexit, could see the return of the marbles to Athens after all this time. What do you think the chances are of it actually happening?
Well, I think that at the moment it's a very interesting point in turning point, I think, in the relations between the European Union and Britain. Of course, as you know, the British Museum is a legal entity of its own. It does not belong to the British state. It is not, you know, just essentially, in a way, that was a clever way of saying that we are not responsible. The British government said we're not responsible for what is going to happen. But I believe that in the end, they have to come to terms with the reality of what this, the Parthenon marbles mean for the people of Greece and what it means for the Europeans as well, because that's a symbol of, as you said before, of the European tradition, essentially. It's not simply the Greek thing. This is where Europe began. So this is, you can, as Giscard d'Estaing said, Athens is the birth certificate of Europe.
Yeah.
So without having that there, as you understand, this having these fragmented beginnings, you create a serious problem of understanding and self-perception. I believe that in a few years they have to come to terms with it and return the marbles. There's no other way. I think they must give them back to Greece in one way or the other. And the legal formula, the legal difficulties, as you know, the legalisms will be used and employed to delay, but I think that sooner or later that will go back to Greece.
Well, Rasidas Karillas, thank you so much for joining us on Nightlife to tell us about the importance of the marbles and the Parthenon. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you, Mike.
Rasidas Karillas is a professor of Byzantine and Modern Greek Studies at the University of Sydney, and that was Mortal Coil. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.